So we will now today start with the last chapter of the Bhakti section of the Bhagavad Gita. This is directly called as the chapter entitled as Bhakti Yoga. So here the connection between chapter 11 and chapter 12 is a little elusive. The basic understanding is that actually chapter 12 starts with the question of Arjuna, that what is better? Is it better to worship the impersonal Brahman, or is it better to worship you in a personal form? So there can be various answers to this question, and different acharyas have answered in different ways. I'll give here what is to me the most coherent or logical connection. As I told earlier, this whole section is focusing on establishing the supremacy of bhakti and the supremacy of Bhagwan. So in general, when we move from this world towards God, the whole process of turning towards spirituality means that I don't need now. It's not hot. That curtain can be pulled. The sun is coming in the eyes. Little bit. That's all. Okay, fine. No problem. So, the whole process of becoming spiritual means to turn our attention from this world towards God. So when we are turning this our attention, first we see the grandeur, the magnificence of this world. And we look at the glory of nature. Many people become naturalists rather than being enamored by technological toys and by technical wizardry. They start thinking actually the calmness, the quietude of nature is much more serene. It is much more attractive. And that to some extent is an elevation towards the mode of goodness. So I am not talking this analysis from the specific flow of the Gita's chapters. I am talking from the overall evolution of spiritual thought. And I will come to the connection in the Gita chapters a little later. But you remember that overall the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita, the direction in which the Bhagavad Gita is flowing, is towards pointing out the ultimate sadhya and ultimate sadhana. So the ultimate sadhya is Bhagwan, the ultimate sadhana is bhakti. That's what the conclusion will be established. So as we move from this world towards God, we move from say ignorance and passion towards goodness. So in ignorance there are fascinations like say intoxication, or nowadays more high tech video games where people go into illusion, or movies, a withdrawal from reality as it is in the world to a illusory world. That is characteristic of mode of ignorance. Mode of passion is trying to make the reality of this world enjoyable, to try to control and dominate, centered physically around sex and psychologically around power. And beyond that, when people come towards goodness, the focus shifts more from control towards observation and appreciation. This world, there is so much beauty already in it. It's not that I have to control and create beauty according to my plans. If I just observe and learn to appreciate, I can see so much beauty in this world. So that is goodness. And to some extent, appreciation of nature is more elevated than, say, the attempt to dominate nature. So the Virata Rupa, in one sense, shows that nature is ultimately the body of God. And rather than become attracted to nature, one should become attracted to God. And that is demonstrated through two things. One is showing also the brutality of nature. Now many of us who live in cities, sometimes we hear about farm life and we may get irritated by the pollution and the noisiness of city life, and we think that the rural life is idyllic. But actually rural life is not just idyllic alone. There's a lot of physical strain and hard work and austerity. For example, working in the farms in the sun is totally exhausting. So it's not that it is comfortable. Material world, no place is comfortable. It's ultimately, whether it is a city or a farm, it is not only city is dukkhalayam and farm is not dukkhalayam. The whole material world is dukkhalayam. But relatively speaking, the farm can be more conducive for spiritual cultivation. What the Bhagavatam does is, what the Bhagavad Gita does is, it shows us firstly that, okay, nature may be magnificent. Nature is contained in, nature is a manifestation of God's body. And nature also has its brutal side. So rather than looking at nature and getting enamored by its beauty, we can go beyond it towards God. Where in God there is none of the brutality. There in Him there is all sweetness. So that is the message of Arjuna's getting a request after seeing the Virat Rupa and getting confused and frightened by it, that this is not what one wants to look. One wants to go beyond this towards God. So now when one is moving further towards God, at that particular point, in general, people turn towards a sort of impersonal spiritual conception that in Vedic terminology is called as Brahman. So okay, one goes beyond nature. Nature is temporary, nature is material, nature is non-eternal, so there must be something beyond that is eternal, and that is the all-pervasive spirit, and the idea is one has to become one with that spirit. So in the evolution, in the spiritual evolution, after say nature worship or nature appreciation will come the spirit worship, the attempt to sort of identify with and devote oneself in a more of a conceptual or intellectual sense rather than a personal sense, because one cannot have a personal relationship with the all-pervading spirit, but still identifying with that. So in that thought, now Arjuna is asking this question. Krishna has told Arjuna that actually this Virat Rupa is revealed from me, and actually my form as you see it is higher than the Virat Rupa, because it is I who revealed it, and this is extremely rare. Then Arjuna asks the question, okay, it's good that, so you are higher, but you are certainly higher than nature worship. But then what about the alternative? What is the alternative? The Brahman worship. And that's how this question comes up. So, now looking at it, is this conceptual thought flow clear? You know, you look at the nature worship is a characteristic of goodness, and you know, if within spiritual realm we could call there is transcendental, and in the transcendental you can say, if you refer to transcendental as just beyond matter, so in the, so if this is ignorance, this is passion, this is goodness, beyond this is spiritual. So in the spiritual there can be the impersonal spiritual, and then there can be devotional where there is personal spirituality. So the 11th chapter takes us beyond the goodness of nature. Then the 12th chapter takes us beyond the impersonal spirituality. Yeah.
There is some relation with the Buddhists and Jains and their teaching. Then comes Shankaracharya. Then comes Vedanta, Advaita, Acharya.
Yeah, good correlation. Yes, from a historical point of view, we can see the evolution of the understanding of the truth beyond this world in Indian history, when the Jains and the Buddhists, they basically rejected this world and tried to focus on a nihilistic, an understanding of spirituality as basically a rejection of matter without any positive conception. Then Advaita Vedanta came in where there was a positive conception, but the positive conception was not entirely positive, in the sense that there was a Brahman, but that Brahman was featureless. And the more positive conception comes up with the with the Vaishnava Acharyas, culminating in Achintya Vidha with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Good correlation.
See that, he wanted to give, they have given directly the Achintya Vidha there. Lord would have given directly the he should not have taken the Shankaracharya and all these things. You know, so I feel again there is something higher than Achintya Vidha, because like he is giving one after another incarnation is coming here.
Okay, so could the Lord not have given the highest directly instead of through this historical progression starting from Buddhism and Advaitism? Ultimately, Krishna can do anything. At the same time, it is that there are certain historical circumstances which sort of rule out certain possibilities. That means at particular times in history, there are certain things which people are receptive to, and certain things people are just not receptive to. And although Krishna can change history and sociology in one strip, generally speaking, Krishna descends and acts, or he sends his representatives to act in a way in which they sort of utilize the existing social forces to the propagation of the spiritual cause. So, you know, from the historical perspective, I gave a class on how Prabhupada's timing in going to the West was perfect. Now, how Prabhupada, you know, the hippie movement which had started, was started as a spiritual movement, a search for something higher beyond the routine, mundane life of the American middle class. And that started more or less in the 1960s, the flower generation, and it sort of peaked in between 1965 to 1970, at the very time when Srila Prabhupada was there. And then after that, because they were exploring so much through drugs and free sex, the spiritual urge got lost and it just became drugs and free sex. And within a few years, after the whole counterculture movement died out. So Srila Prabhupada, in a historical sense, went at exactly the right time. Krishna could have made Prabhupada successful whenever he would have gone. But the way Prabhupada went, the way Prabhupada presented, now America was more receptive than ever before to that, at that particular time. So generally, there are the historical circumstances. See, an expert dancer can dance anywhere. But if there is a stage set up, then the expert dancer's full expertise gets revealed in a very excellent way, in a pleasant way for everyone to see. So just the setting of the stage does not decrease the credit of the dancer. The dancer still has to be expert to win the applause of the audience. But still, the setting of the stage is also important. So like that, the historical or sociological circumstances, they are the stage. And Krishna or the Acharyas, they come and perform at that particular stage. So Krishna, so that's why we have to understand the cultural aspect and the spiritual aspect in any Acharya's teachings. The cultural aspect can be contextual. The spiritual aspect is eternal. The cultural aspect, just because it is contextual doesn't mean that it can be rejected. But it may not be entirely applicable now as it was applicable at that time. For example, we see in Krishna's times, Krishna had an extraordinarily large number of wives, 16,108. But polygamy was quite common. But Srila Prabhupada, he established Krishna's teaching, spiritual teaching in this world, but he did not recommend polygamy within ISKCON. So like that, there are many aspects of the culture which may not be relevant right now. So the spiritual message is presented by the Acharyas according to the culture. So cultural point of view, actually, the exploitation of the lower caste by the higher caste and the resentment against Vedic culture was such that the receptivity to Vedic spirituality would not have been much. In fact, from 5th century BC to almost like 6th, 7th century till the Shankaracharya came, Buddhism and Jainism was ruling India. Almost large parts of the world, of the country, were ruled by Buddhist kings or Jain kings. So today they might just seem to be small religions, but they were huge and influential at a particular time. In fact, so much was the influence that even against Chanakya's wish, now Chandragupta Maurya was made into a king from just he was born as a, according to certain sources, he was born as a son of a royal society woman, and then Chanakya made him into a king. But towards the end of his life, even Chandragupta got influenced by a Jain monk and he renounced the kingdom and became a Jain. And then Bindusar, his son, became the king, and Chanakya was so disgusted. He in his Arthashastra writes that one of the rules that a king should follow is never associate with Buddhists and Jains. He says that, why? It is not that he is so much against the doctrine, but Buddhism and Jainism are such passive ideas that a Kshatriya has to be positive, he has to be active, he has to be assertive, he has to be dynamic. And in Buddhism and Jainism, the whole idea just forget the world and transcend the world. go beyond the world. So that is a, not at all a suitable idea for a king. So the point which I am making is the particular cultural situation was such that other forms of spirituality would have been very difficult to accept at that time. Who? That was 1000 years later. Shankaracharya came in 6th to 7th century BC, AD.
Yeah,
so at
that time, Buddhists were ruling.
Yeah.
So to bring Vedas into picture and saying that impersonalism is what all in all, he would have said that as per the Veda, personalism is what all in all.
See.
It's how it will get easily. Like
oh, because the whole idea is how are impersonalism and Buddhist thought related?
Yeah,
actually, yeah, but you know, first of all, Buddhism and impersonalism, they are basically intellectual clones, with only the name being different. Now, whatever are the characteristics of the Shunya, basically those are the characteristics of the Brahma. Ultimately, the Shunya is nothing. But what is Brahman? They won't say Brahman is nothing. But Brahman basically doesn't have any qualities, doesn't have any activities, doesn't have any form. It is not material. It doesn't have anything to do with matter. So essentially, conceptually, it is the same. And there was a Buddhist teacher, Nagarjuna, who very famous scholar in Buddhism. So he had talked about a two-level reality. You know, at this level, the world seems real. But when we go beyond that, then the world becomes... Then we go beyond the world and we realize that it is unreal. It is completely false. So that was essentially adopted by Shankaracharya in his two-level Brahman idea. There is a paramarthik and there is a vyavaharik reality and this paramarthik reality. So vyavaharik is that okay, in the vyavahar, in the conduct of this world, you and I are different. I and God are also different. But in the paramarthik, no, there is nothing. So another thing that... Shankaracharya's Advaitic teachings did was it sort of unified the followers of the Vedic culture, whoever they were there, into one rubric, into one banner. Okay, whatever be the deity you are worshipping, ultimately you have to go beyond that and merge into Brahman. And that way he basically united everyone. So at that time that was extremely powerful. So of course another way to understand this is that it is not, Vedanta Sutra actually refutes Buddhism. Now we may wonder, specifically it takes Buddhist doctrine and refutes it. Shatdarshan also, but Buddhism also it does. Now we wonder how if Buddha came 2500 years ago and Vedanta Sutra was written 5000 years ago. Then how can Vedanta Sutra refute Buddhism? So the answer is that actually Buddhist thought predates Buddha. You know, the idea that we have to go beyond this world and there is a void into which we have to merge, that is in a sense eternally reincarnating doctrine in this world. You know, atheism is an eternally reincarnating doctrine. Impersonalism, voidism, all these are eternally reincarnating doctrines. They will always be there. And depending on how influential are the proponents of these doctrines, those doctrines will become prominent or they will stay marginal. So, when Vyasadeva is refuting Buddhism, he is not refuting specifically the ideas, not specifically the historical Buddha, but the ideas that predated the appearance of Buddha. So, they became prominent at that particular time. And for those souls who want some spiritual seeming excuses to continue their defiance of Krishna, for them, voidism and impersonalism offer pathways for that kind of rebelliousness. So that's why they will always be there. And Krishna, in a sense, provides for them. When you say Nityo Nityanam Chetanas Chetananam Eko Bahunam Yobidhati Kaman, that one maintains all others. So, Vidhati Kaman, he maintains their desires. Those desires are not just the desires for sensual enjoyment, that includes also the desires for intellectual gratification. So Krishna only provides all these alternatives, all these various sort of speculative doctrines by which people who want, they can choose to rebel against Krishna. It's just like a teacher who gives a multiple choice question. The teacher only gives the wrong answers, and the purpose is that the student should study and then take the right answer. So like that, Krishna only gives all, in a sense, all these alternatives. And in the Padma Puran, it is described that where this verse comes, Prachannam Baudham Uchyate. Mayavadamasa Shastram Maya Kalpita Devi Kalau Brahmana Murtina Mayavadamasa Shastram Prachannam Baudham Uchyate. So Lord Shiva is telling this to Parvati Devi. Maya Kalpita Devi, by me, O goddess, O Parvati Devi, Kalau Brahmana Murtina, in Kali Yuga, in the form of Brahmana, Mayavadam Asat Shastram. So this is not actually the teaching of Shastra, it's Asat Shastram. And what is it actually? Prachannam Baudham Uchyate. It is covered Buddhism. So he says that he teaches this, so for the purpose of, it is expected to accelerate Kali Yuga, to separate the sincere from the hypocritical. Those who want to defy God and still appear to be spiritual, Mayavad offers an alternative for them. So you can see the effect of Mayavad in two ways. One is, it brought acceptability and respectability for Vedic culture within the broad Indian situation by refuting Buddhism. So most people are generally, even if whatever they are religious, they are just culturally religious. They are not ideologically religious. In terms of, say, many people come to Janmashtami temple. Now, they don't have much ideological or philosophical understanding. Just culturally, they are religious. So that cultural religiosity was facilitated by the spreading of Advaitism by Shankaracharya. And that created a setting. Because even when Shankaracharya came along, Shankaracharya himself, he had his Narasimha deity and he worshipped Narasimha Dev. So he did not entirely reject deity worship. So all that sort of deity worship and bhakti was facilitated by the broad establishment of the spiritual culture. But there were people who also want to be ideologically defiant. And for the general mass of people, the impersonalism sort of created a safe enclave for practicing spiritual culture, Vedic culture. But for the sort of ideologues, it became a means for continuing to defy God by not surrendering to Krishna while still appearing to be spiritual. So in that way, that ideology can serve different purposes for different people. It's clear? Okay. So I was making some, what was the point I was making when you asked this question? Okay, so now I was going to speak about how all this is related with the flow of the Bhagavad Gita. So that is centered around one critical verse, 9.15 in the Bhagavad Gita. So in fact, the whole 10th, 11th and 12th chapters are an unfoldment of 9.15. So 9.15 we'll recite before we go into the 10th chapter. Jnana yagena chapyanye yajanto mam upasate ekatvena pruthaktvena na pruthaktvena bahudha vishvato mukham mukham. So Krishna before this has given the two poles. This is 9.10 is, I'll just go a little bit into flow. 9.10 is maya adhyakshena prakriti. And then Krishna talks about the extreme Mayavadis in 9.11 and 12. Avjananti mama mudha moghasha moha karmano. Then he talks about the pure devotees. That is, he talks about Mahatmanastu mam partha and satatam kirtayanto mam. And then he talks about in between. So those who defy him, those who devote themselves to him and who are in between. So these people have jnana and they worship. So how they worship? Krishna gives three alternatives over here. He says there, ekatvena pruthaktvena bahudha vishvatomukham. So vishvatomukham refers to the virata rupa, to the worship of the universal form. So Krishna describes that briefly from 9.16 to 19, and he elaborately shows how universal worship of the universal form should culminate in his worship, because he is the reveal of the universal form in chapter 11. And another sense, chapter 10 also does the same thing, because the vibhuti within the universe is a manifestation of his vibhuti. Now, the other point of pruthaktvena bahudha, that refers to the worship of the various gods, various demigods, that is talked about in this 9th chapter itself, in the verses that talk about titam bhuktva sarvalokam vishalam ananyas chintayanto mam, and then so 9.20 to 9.27 we can say, where Krishna says that those who go to the demigods, they get temporary results, and if you worship me, you come to me. So there, basically the later part of the 9th chapter is a contrast between demigod worship and Krishna worship. So Pruthaktvena Bahudha is dealt with after this, 9.20 till almost 9.34, where the glory of pure devotional service is contrasted with demigod worship. Then Vishvatomukham is dealt with in 10th and 11th chapter. And Ekatvena is dealt with in 12th chapter. So this Ekatvena is not the same as Mayavad. Mayavad and Brahmavad are two different things. So 9.11 and 12 talk about Mayavad. That is an option which Krishna has already condemned. He says, Avajananti Mam Mudha. This verse is the Ekatvena is not so much the idea that I am God, or rather I am the object of worship. It is more conceptual awareness that say I and the absolute are made of the same Brahman. Therefore, I can aham brahmasmi. See, aham brahmasmi is not necessarily a Mayavadi utterance. It's basically the realization that I am Brahman. And that Vaishnavas also accept it. Now, Tattvamasi, it's a Vedic utterance, it's Upanishadic utterance. Tattvamasi also, what does it mean? It seems that it actually means that there is some sort of oneness between you and that absolute truth. The nature of that oneness is not explicitly stated. It is often used by Mayavadis. But the point which I am making here is that Ekatvena in and of itself doesn't connote Mayavad. It just conveys the idea of oneness. So this idea of oneness is what will be explored in the 12th chapter. So from the point of view of flow of the Gita, this is the connection. So these three alternatives between the two extremes of Mayavad and pure devotion. Three alternatives are demigod worship, Vishwarupa Upasana, and Brahman Upasana. So these three will be explored as intermediates between these two poles. And in exploring this, Brahmavad Krishna will see that he will not condemn or reject it. He will not say that this is Moghasha Mogha Karmano. He will say that in 12.6 he says Klesho Adhiktarastesham. It is troublesome. He doesn't say, Mogha means it is futile. But Klesha means it is troublesome. But still, they will also come to me gradually. There is a difference between the two. So this is the connection from the textual flow of the Gita. The immediate impetus for this question is that Arjuna is basically exploring and understanding various concepts that are familiar to him from the culture that he was living in. So there is nothing directly in the preceding discussion in the Virat Rupa which prompts this question. But now Krishna has said, okay, I am higher than the Virat Rupa and my form is very rare. Then Arjuna has this question, okay, now you have told that we should worship you, mat paramo. So now what is better? Is it better to devote yourselves to you or to worship the impersonal Brahman? So it's not a specific question originating from some specific statement that Krishna has made precedingly, but it's a generic question arising from the culture in which Arjuna was living. Okay, so let's move forward now. What happened? Arjuna vacha evam satata yuktaye bhaktastvam paryupasate ye chapyaksharam avyaktam tesham ke yoga vittamaha So evam satata yuktaye. Evam means thus. So thus is referring to what was earlier. Those who worship, as you have mentioned earlier, matkarma krun matparamo, 11.55, satata yuktaye. So those who always engage in this, bhaktastvam paryupas, they worship you like this. And on the other hand, ye, so ye generally refers to these. In Hindi, we are ya log. So ye. So, and on the other hand, ye cha apya aksharam avyaktam. Those who are fixed on the akshara and avyakta, the unmanifest and the imperishable. Tesham ke yoga vittamaha. Who among them is the best? Now we know the word tamaha is referring to tama. This is not, it is not referring to tamo guna over here. It refers to, like we have tara and tama. Uttara, it refers uttama. It is the best. So whereas Krishna used this superlative sense earlier. Guhyatama, correct, that's true. He has used 9.2. One more very important place. 6.47. Yoginam api sarvesham madgate nantaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yomam same yuktatamo mataha. So he has yuktatamo. So what it means is yukta, yuktatara and yuktatama. It's the most intimately united with me. So that's superlative sense. In English we have good, better and best. So best is the highest superlative. So like that, now Arjuna is recognizing that both are good, but which is, who is most intimately united with you? So this, the phrasing of this question itself indicates that he is not referring to Mayavad. Because Mayavad is not at all united with Krishna. Krishna said avjananti and moghasha. So the phrasing of the question is itself referring to people who are on the spiritual path. And who are moving forwards. So now let's move forward and look at Krishna's reply. Shri Bhagavan Vacha,
Shri Bhagavan Vacha,
Mayaveshimano Yema, Mayaveshimano Yema, Nityayukta Upasate, Nityayukta Upasate, Shaddhava, Shaddhaya Parayo Petas, Parayo Petas, Teme Yukta Tamamataha, Teme Yukta Tamamataha. Krishna's answer is quite unambiguous. Mai aveshya mano yema. Mai is very clear. Unto me. Mano yema. And if there's any doubt which is being referred, nitya yukta. Sevam satata yukta. Almost equivalent. Satata yukta, nitya yukta. And then there is paryupasate, upasate. So Krishna is clearly referring here to the first category of people. Shraddhaya parayopetas. With transcendental faith. Shraddha, not just shraddha, but parayashraddha. Parashraddha. What is the significance of parashraddha? Actually, even the Mayavadis have Shraddha in Bhakti. But their Shraddha is not transcendental. It is utilitarian. They do believe that by Bhakti, one can rise from the lower modes towards goodness. And one can even touch transcendence by that. But ultimately, to go beyond, go completely beyond, one has to give up Bhakti. But that is not transcendental faith. That is just material or utilitarian faith. So Krishna is telling, Shraddhaya parayopetas. And he says, Teme yuktatamo mataha. They are the most intimately united with me. So after describing this, now Krishna will explore the alternative. What has Arjuna said? What is the status of those whom Arjuna has referred to? Yetva aksharam anirdesham, aksharam anirdesham, avyaktam paryupasate, avyaktam paryupasate, sarvatra gama chintyam cha. Kutastham achalam dhruvam, kutastham achulam dhruvam, sanyamendriya gramam, yamendriya gramam, sarvatra samabuddhayaha, sarvatra samabuddhayaha, te prapnuvanti mameva, te prapnuvanti mameva, sarvabhutahiterataha, sarvabhutahiterataha. So Krishna again uses the two same words which Arjuna has used in his question, avyakta and akshara. So again it's clear what he is referring to. Yetu akshara nirdesha, and he uses further characteristics of that object over him. Anirdesha, sarvatragam, achintyam. And he says, te prapnumanti mameva, they will also attain me. So now in Krishna's, Prabhupada adds over here, they at last achieve me. Now there is no direct at last in the verse itself. Now, is this a imposition by Prabhupada? No, it's indicated in the next verse. Where is the klesho diktarasnesha? So Prabhupada is giving us what is the next verse over here. When he's saying, at last they will come to me. What he's saying, yes, they will come to me. The mameva, te prapnuvanti mameva. But what all they have to do? So Arjuna, when he talks about the bhaktas, he itself uses sadhana. Evam satata yukta ye. they engage my devotional service. But for the impersonal Brahman, what they have to do? Sanyamendriya gramam, they have to regulate the senses. Sarvatra samabuddhaya, they have to become equipoised towards everything. And they have to sort of become benevolent towards all living beings. So basically, they have to become equipoised in everything. Equipoised towards the sense objects, equipoised towards people, equipoised towards situations. And by that, they can go beyond this world. So now Ramanujacharya, in his commentary, analyzes this section differently. He says that this verse doesn't necessarily refer to Brahman. And Arjuna's question is not necessarily referring to Brahman at all. Actually, if you look at these characteristics, these are all characteristics of the soul that are given in the second chapter of the Gita. You know, if you see 2.24, 25, the Sarvatragam comes, Achalam comes, Dhruvam comes, Achintya also comes, Avyaktoyam Achintyoyam Avikaryoyam Uchyate, Sarvatragam Achintya, Avyaktoyam Achintya, Nirvik Avikaryoyam Uchyate. Like that, there are 2.24, 25, you see, these verses talk about these qualities. Achintyoyam. So these are all qualities of the soul also. So what Ramacharya says is that the question is, at Krishna, now you have described two ways of getting spiritual realization. One is directly devoting oneself to you. That means fixing the mind on you and devoting yourself oneself to you. The other is by cultivating Atmagyan. So when he says, the question of Arjuna is, evam satat yuktaya bhaktastvam parivati, ye chapya aksharam avyaktam, tesham kayo guptana. So ye chapya aksharam avyaktam, this refers to those who meditate on Atmagyan. Rather than focusing on Bhagawan, they focus on, oh, I am not the body, I am the soul. I am the soul, I am the soul. And in this way, they try to detach themselves from the material world. And they try to gain spiritual realization. So which of these two paths is better? So, and Krishna says, yes, even by meditating on the soul, by contemplating one's spiritual identity, one will attain me. Because how will that happen? First one understands, I am not the body, I am the soul. And gradually, one can, over a period of time, recognize that the soul is spiritual. So the soul has to come from somewhere. And then there must be some spiritual nature from which it is coming. And there, one can aspire to return back to the spiritual nature. And te praapnumanti maameva, they can also attain me. So this is also a valid understanding. Srila Prabhupada doesn't give this understanding. Baldev Vidya Bhushan uses this a little bit in this purport. I have not referred to Baldev Vidya Bhushan's commentary too much. Because he uses a technical categorization of the sadhakas into three categories. And then he analyzes the whole Bhagavad Gita more or less from that framework. So, it gives a very coherent and excellent understanding of the Gita. But then Srila Prabhupada does not use that categorization of the sadhakas into three categories. So that's why I have not used that over here, because we would like to just stick to the text of the Gita and to Srila Prabhupada's purports, and then have the previous acharya's insights to illuminate as much as is possible. So here, we will not go into this understanding of the Atma, but it is also a valid understanding, and Krishna's answer still remains valid. Actually, the next verse then will refer to that, okay, actually by meditating on the Atma, if you try to become spiritually perfect, it is a troublesome process. Because the object of meditation is not necessarily very pleasant. It is relatively static. When we are going to fix the mind in Krishna, then Krishna is a person who performs so many pastimes. And fixing the mind on Krishna and devoting oneself to Krishna is easier. But if I just have to fix my mind on Atma, what do I actually do? Isn't it? Just while I am doing all my activities, I'll think, I am not the body, I am the soul, I am not the body, I am the soul, I am not the body, I am the soul. Now how long? That is not a very pleasant meditation. So in that sense, this sort of meditation will be troublesome. And normally, Aham Brahmasmi is not necessarily accompanied with the idea that the Atma is a person. We understand that I am right now a person. But the idea could also come that, okay, my personality is just a product of illusion. And so even the Atma is not considered to be a person. Atma is just considered to be some spiritual existence. The nature of that existence is also not very clear. That's why the epithet avyakta is also used over here. And it's very difficult to make spiritual advancement with this kind of conception. So that will be mentioned by Krishna in the next verse. Klesho dhiktaras tesham.
Klesho dhiktaras tesham.
अव्यक्तासक्तचेतसाम् अव्यक्तासक्तचेतसाम् अव्यक्ता हि गतिर्दुःखम् देहवद्भिरवाप्यते देहवद्भिरवाप्यते. सो क्लेशो दिक्तरस्तेषाम् एक्चुअली देयर इज क्लेश अव्यक्त आसक्त चेतसाम. व्हेन द माइंड इज फिक्स्ड ऑन अव्यक्त देयर इज क्लेश बिकॉज द आई सेड अगेन द ऑब्जेक्ट ऑफ मेडिटेशन इज नॉट वेरी सैटिस्फाइंग. अव्यक्त ही गतिर दुखम द प्रोग्रेस ऑन दैट. गति कैन रेफर टू डेस्टिनेशन, गति कैन रेफर टू स्पीड. सो मूविंग फॉरवर्ड्स इज दुखम. सो कृष्णा यूज द वर्ड ट्वाइस. You know, again the avyakta comes twice, and the unpleasantness, the troublesomeness is also described twice. Klesha and dukkha. So it is very clear. Dehavad bhiravapyate. So for the embodied soul, which has become completely inactive, is extremely troublesome. It's not at all pleasant. So the jnana path, where the one tries to meditate on the Brahman, it does not offer a very satisfying object for meditation, and it does not allow one to perform activities, because one just all activities are material and all activities have to be given up. That's why it's not easy to practice this path. Now, after describing this, again Krishna will contrast. Okay, so first he said the devotees are better. In 12.2, 12.345, he describes the Brahmavadis. He says the path is troublesome. And then, why is this trouble not present in the devotional path? Krishna will answer in 12.6 and 7. Yetu sarvani karmani. Mai sanyasya matparaha. Mai sanyasya matparaha. Ananyenaiva yogena. Ananyenaiva yogena. Mam dhyayanta upasate. Mam dhyayanta upasate. Teshamaham samudharta. Teshamaham samudharta. Mrityu samsara sagarat. Mrityu samsara sagarat. Bhavami nachirat partha. Amina chirat partha. Maya veshita chetasam. Veshita chetasam. So he's describing the activity that a devotee should do and the reciprocation that the devotee will get from me. So itu sarvani karvani mai sanyas. So devotees, they offer all their activities to me. They make me the perfect goal. So this matparaha is the same as 11.55. What? Matparamo. Same. So it's clear what Krishna is referring to again. And then ananyenaiva yogena mam dhyayanto upasate. Ananyenaiva yogena, this ananya is the same word which is used in 11.54. What was that? My natu mam shakyase drishtum. No, what are the words? Bhaktya tu ananyaya shakya ahamevam vidho arjuna. So ananya is also the same. So the correlation is very clear. There's no ambiguity. There's no scope for misinterpretation. This is referring to this and this is referring to this. It's very clear. So what happens to the such people, those who meditate on me? Tesham aham samudharta. I deliver them personally from material existence. I extricate them. Mrityu samsara sagarat. So we know the picture of Krishna coming on Garuda, or Vishnu coming on Garuda and extending his hand and lifting the soul from material existence. So in the Vamana Purana, it is said that when a devotee devotes himself to Krishna, actually, Baldev Devashi quotes this in Govinda Bhashya, that the more and more the devotee devotes himself to Krishna, Krishna finds separation from the devotee intolerable. And that's why Krishna personally comes on Garuda, picks up the devotee and takes him back directly to the spiritual world. So teshamaham samudharta. And when will this happen? Nachirat partha. It won't take a long time. As contrasted with klesha over there and dukkhavaddirgati. Here it is nachirat partha. Slowly, it'll quickly happen. Hare Krishna, humble obeisances. So, Mai Aveshita Chetasam. So he says, let the mind be fixed on me. And by this, one will attain, I'll come and rescue such a person. So now here Krishna more or less completes the answer to Arjuna's question over here. And from here onwards, now Krishna will describe how bhakti can be practiced. So Arjuna's question in 12.1 extends from 12.2 to 12.7. He very clearly establishes that bhakti should be what is practiced. Now, practically, how can one practice bhakti? That will be described from 12.8 to 12.12. So, in a sense, Krishna first mentions bhakti in 7.1. You know, Maya Asakta Manaha Partha. So then the sort of the flow of thought ascends upwards, upwards, upwards till it reaches Hare Krishna. So the flow of thought moves from 7.1 till here 12.7, where the glory of bhakti is fully established. You know, all other conceptions are subordinated and harmonized ultimately with bhakti. Now, when Krishna has taken his development of thought to its summit, then he starts off, drops a ladder of love, a ladder of mercy. Okay, this is the glory of bhakti, but how can you come to that level? So he gives multiple options. So he will give various levels at which one can practice bhakti in the next series of verses. So first he gives the highest level, and then afterwards he moves downwards to lower and lower levels. So let's discuss these levels now. Mayeva manadhatsva. Mai buddhim niveshaya. Mai buddhim niveshaya. Nivasishyasi mayeva. Mayeva. Ata urdhvam na samshaya. Ata urdhvam na samshaya. So Krishna tells, Mai eva manadhatsva. Fix your mind on me and let your intelligence be devoted to me. Nivesh, fix your intelligence also in me. So when you do these two things, what will happen? Actually, what to speak of coming to me, you will be residing in me only. Nivasishyasi mai eva ata urdhvam na samshaya. So you are as good as back with me only. You are with me only. So this is talking especially about offering the subtle body to Krishna. You know, actually, Prabhupada writes in the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita that the art of Krishna consciousness is to fix the mind and intelligence on Krishna. And ultimately, we are where our mind is. Now, if our mind is thinking about cricket, we might be sitting in a college classroom, but we are actually in the cricket field, imagining what is happening over there. So, if our mind and intelligence gets attached to Krishna, then wherever we are, it doesn't matter. Now externally we can be doing various activities, and this is essentially the instruction that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave to Rupa Sanatana Goswami. Now, sir, like a paramour. Now the idea is not become immoral, but just as a paramour, physically she may be in her a woman who loves a paramour. She may physically be in her husband's house, but her mind and intelligence, her heart are with her lover. So like that, Krishna says, act like this. You know, just give your mind and intelligence to me, then you will reside in me. This is the way to practice bhakti. Offer our heart to Krishna. Now, this is the level of pure devotional service. And when somebody cannot practice this pure devotional service, then Krishna gives one level lower. He describes, Atha chittam samadhatum, chittam samadhatum, nashaknosi mai sthiram, nashaknosi mai sthiram, abhyasa yogena tato, abhyasa yogena tato, ma michhaptum dhananjaya, michhaptum dhananjaya. So, atha chittam samadhatum na shaknosi. If it is not possible for your chitta to find samadhan in this, if you cannot fix your mind on me, then abhyasa yoga. Practice, abhyasa is in the practice. So, the yoga of practice. This is sadhana bhakti. So, practice sadhana bhakti. And it's very significant. Krishna says, what is the purpose of sadhana bhakti? It is mam ichhaptum dhananjaya. By the practice of sadhana bhakti, our attraction to Krishna increases, our desire for Krishna increases. So, every day when we chant Hare Krishna, every day when we do the various limbs of the devotional service, taking darshan, studying scriptures, rendering seva, the purpose of all this is to increase our attraction to Krishna. And even he says the same thing, Kriyeta Bhagavatyadha Tanmanyedita Muttamam. Prahlad Maharaj, when he describes Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu, the verse after that he says, Iti pumsarpita Vishnu bhaktischenana lakshana kriyeta bhagavatyadha tanmanyedita muttamam. So the best education is that which involves offering the Shravanam Kirtanam 9 activities to Lord Vishnu, by which one's attraction to him increases. So the purpose of sadhana bhakti is to increase our attraction to Krishna. And how does this happen? It's basically a revival of our dormant love for Krishna, which is presently misdirected. Now all of us as souls naturally have attraction to Krishna. So we are all sort of suffering from amnesia, where we have forgotten Krishna. So some people ask this question, it is so if you have a father and you want something from your father, you won't chant papa, 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 papa. So why should you chant Krishna, Krishna, Krishna? So if you want a chocolate from papa, you won't chant papa, papa. Actually, when we don't want any chocolate from Krishna. The purpose of chanting the names of Krishna is not to get something from him. It is to revive our memory of him. And if some scriptures, some rituals talk how you chant this many names and then your son will get married or this will happen, your health will get recovered, those are fringe benefits. Just like the parents may tell a child that, okay, you take this medicine, then you will get this chocolate. Now the child may think that, okay, the real thing is to take the chocolate. And for that, okay, if I don't take this medicine, I'll take the medicine. But actually from the parents' perspective, the real thing is the medicine itself and the effect that medicine will produce, that is curing the child. And chocolate is just a fringe benefit. So like that, sometimes even the chanting of the holy names will be associated with some material benefits. For example, at the end of Vishnu Sahasranam, there is an elaborate phala shruti. And then it is described that the Kshatriyas will always be victorious, the Vaishyas will always have lots of cows, and like the Brahmanas will become knowledgeable. The phala shruti is given for everyone. That is true, but then the Falashruti is also mentioned that one will go beyond material existence. Janma mrityu jara dukkhair vasudeva bhaktanam ashubham vidyate kochit janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkham naivo apajayate. So this is the actual benefit. Vasudeva bhaktanam, they will go beyond the miseries of material existence. That is also mentioned, but people don't highlight that so much. People highlight other things. Bhagavatam also gives these benefits. For example, at the end of Prutha Maharaj pastime, at the end of Bali Maharaj pastime, then we were told, okay, those who hear this, they will get this benefit. Those are fringe benefits. The real benefit is the development of love for Krishna. So, that is the purpose of Abhyasa Yoga. It is Mam Ichhaptum Dhananjaya, to become devoted to Krishna. And now somebody may say, actually, this is also not possible for me. Then Krishna gives one more alternative. He says, work for me. Abhyasepyasamarthosi. Sepyasamarthosi. Matkarma paramo bhava. Matkarma paramo bhava. Madartham api karmani. Madartham api karmani. Kurvan siddhim avapsyasi. Kurvan siddhim avapsyasi. So, that there is a progression in this ladder is clear, because it is abhyasepyasamarthosi. You cannot do abhyas, then what should you? Matkarma paramo bhava. Make my work the most important thing of your life. And by doing your work for me also, you will return to me. Kurvan siddhim avapsyasi. You will actually come back to me. So, I write these small articles in the Bhagavad Gita every day. So, I wrote an article about this kind, locating ourselves on the Gita's ladder of love. So, what is happening over here? So, the first level is 12.8. Offer the mind and energy to Krishna, entirely live in him. Practice sadhana bhakti and fix the mind on him. Then, actually this mat karma paramo bhava, it has two sub-levels in it.
It's visible there?
Yeah. So, the first level is direct. Just do his work. That is, render service to him. And, second level is indirect. Offer him the fruits of our work. So, in a sense, we could say, this matkarma paramo bhava is the level where brahmacharis and grahasthas work in these two levels. Brahmacharis are doing Krishna's work. And grahasthas are offering the fruits of their work to Krishna. Actually, offering the fruits of the work to Krishna is not karma yoga. Because in karma yoga, the ultimate goal is not very clear. If the ultimate goal is known to be Bhagwan, then it is bhakti yoga, although it is presently being practiced at the karma yoga stage. The idea of karma yoga primarily is that one is more attached to one's work than one is attached to Krishna. As I will do it for Krishna, but I will do what I like to do. Okay, I like to sing, I like to write, I like to manage, I like to do this. I like to speak, I'll do this for Krishna. But other things, I don't like them so much. I won't do them. Yeah, whatever it is. No, if I'm doing it for Krishna, then it is no longer karma yoga. It is actually bhakti practice at the level of Nishkam karma yoga. See, generally speaking, how do you define a particular path? Is it just by the external activities? If it were only by the external activities, then we are using computer, we are traveling in cars, we are living in cities, we would be karmis actually. Then if it's just work, so actually the level of a person is determined ultimately by the motivation, by what the goal of the person is. So if the goal of the person is beyond this world, that person becomes a yogi. The goal is not, as long as the goal is material, is a karmic, karmakandi or a karmi or a vikarmi, whatever, depending on how much that person is adhering to or defying scriptural morality. Once the goal becomes beyond this world, then it becomes karma yoga. And once the beyond the goal is clear and it's Krishna, then it is actually bhakti. But it's bhakti practiced at the level of karma yoga. That means, so now all of us also, we cannot say that we are Shuddha Bhaktas. And so in a sense, in our Krishna conscious practice, you know, we, our morning program is like we are practicing at the level of 12.9. You know, we are doing sadhana bhakti. And the rest of the day, we are doing working for Krishna. So we are living at 12.10. So in this way, Srila Prabhupada has given us a facility through the Krishna conscious movement by which we can fit ourselves at a ladder, at a rung on the ladder that is compatible, that is suitable for us. And by these we can gradually rise to the higher levels. Krishna reassures, Kurvan Siddhim Avapsyasi. By doing this also, you will come to me, you will attain me. So in that sense, Krishna gives the assurance. So we'll just discuss the next verse, and then the verse after that is a little complicated. We will discuss that tomorrow elaborately. Athaitadapyasaktosi Kartum madhyogam ashritaha Kartum madhyogam ashritaha Sarva karma falatyagam Karma falatyagam Tataha kuru yata atmavan. So, now, if you can't work for me, then just renounce the fruits of your work. And by that, yat atmavan. Atmavan means, like we have dhanavan means possessor of dhana. So atmavan means possessor of the soul. What does it mean, atmavan, in that sense? It means that become spiritually conscious. Become possessive of your soul. Become the knower of your soul. At least, if I'm attached to material things, oh, I want this, I want that, then those things possess my consciousness. I try to possess them. So, become, if we renounce our attachment to those things, then what happens is, we can stay in spiritual consciousness. So, become Atmavan. So, here Krishna doesn't... So, Krishna doesn't directly talk about... Nishkam Karma Yoga explicitly in terms of offering the fruits of work to him. So he includes that in the previous verse itself. You know, work for me, that's why I said, in work for me there are two levels implicit. Matkarama Parama, directly work for me, or offer the fruits of your work to me. And the level below that is, okay, if you can't, and Prabhupada writes in the purport over here, okay, if you cannot offer the, because of certain circumstances, so if you cannot offer the fruits of your work to Krishna directly, then at least offer them to some good cause. By offering them to a good cause, we at least develop selflessness. If I am using all the fruits of my work for my own enjoyment, then I am becoming selfish. So by at least I am becoming selfless. So, you know, when for example we had a midday meal or food for life program, and people give charity for that. Now, what is objectionable is, if the charity that they could directly have given to Krishna, they give that to such programs. That is objectionable. You know, because what is happening is, they could be practicing bhakti at a higher level, but they are being relegated down to a lower level. But those who are anyway not going to give charity directly to Krishna, let them give some charity to a humanitarian cause that is connected with Krishna. So what is objectionable is, in a sense, is not desirable. If in the temple people come, and in the temple there are big advertisements of midday meal and food for life, and people think that, okay, instead of giving in that money in the hundi to the temple, to Krishna, or giving some donation for Krishna's deity, or Krishna, or some direct devotional service, actually both of these are equivalent, and this is much better. So because, you know, people are being fed over here. So if the two are portrayed as equivalent, and people are given alternatives. So it has happened in some temples. You know, some temples, when you come out of the temples, I'm talking about ISKCON temples only, you come out of the temple, and one side is become an ISKCON life member, and they donate for food for life. So now, from the people's point of view, both appear equal, you know. Anyway, oh, this is much more, you know, something tangible is happening, people will get fed. So if we portray both of them as equal, then we are not actually representing Krishna's teachings properly. But if we just outlaw the other, say that this cannot be done by ISKCON, then also we are not representing Krishna's teachings properly. Isn't it? Because Krishna also accommodates this as one of the levels. So, but it should be clear that that is a lower level. That is a lower level. But those who cannot practice at a higher level, we should be able to accommodate them also and give them a facility. So that way, humanitarian work is not against the principles of devotional service. It becomes against only when it is portrayed as an equivalent substitute. Because when we portray it as an equivalent substitute, people immediately take it as a superior substitute. Because they say, hey, this is much better. Something practical will be done for people. So they will start seeing it as not only equivalent but superior. That's where it becomes wrong. But in the hierarchy, sarva karma falatyagam, sacrifice the fruits of the work. And most people, they will be ready to sacrifice it more for a humanitarian cause if they don't have philosophical understanding or devotional attraction. So gradually, if they become connected to Krishna, they will develop the philosophical understanding, they will develop the devotional attraction also. And then later on, they may give to Krishna's cause. And it has happened with many influential people. They were introduced to Krishna consciousness through such charitable programs. And then they got connected with devotees. And then they started practicing devotional service. And then they contributed to devotional causes also. So what is a lower level on the ladder should not be rejected or outlawed. But at the same time, it should not be made as an equivalent level. So now after this, Krishna will give in the last verse, he will actually give four levels. And those four levels are probably among the most confusing levels. So 12.12 is probably is one of the most complex verses of the Bhagavad Gita. So we'll discuss this tomorrow early morning fresh. Tomorrow morning. yes. Yeah, quick question, Ru. Yeah, that is both a donation for deity and donation for feeding Vaishnava. They are both devotional service only because it's directly connected with Krishna only. So generally speaking, if somebody is a person who, if you know a person is say earning money by immoral means, then in general it is best that we don't use that donation directly for our devotional activity. See, the money gets purified, but ultimately we have a certain level of consciousness and we may not be pure enough to absorb it, so we may become contaminated. So if somebody is earning money by immoral means and that person wants to give donation of part of it to Krishna, we don't have to refuse that. Of course, we shouldn't just accept that and tell him continue your immoral activities and give money to Krishna. No, we should also try to educate him. We can give him some books. If that person is receptive, we can also give him higher understanding of life. But if some money is coming from sort of dubious sources, then it is best to offer directly to Krishna. But otherwise, if there is a person practicing average level of morality, then both are from his perspective equivalent. Whether contributing to feeding the Vaishnavas or serving the deities, both are equivalent. So that person can be, according to his own inspiration, that person can give. The purificatory potency of both from his perspective is equivalent because both are being offered to Krishna. But from our perspective, how much can we absorb? We have to see our adhikar and accordingly decide that. Clear? Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki Shrila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Tai Gaur Premanande. Thank you.